this evening brings up. Dear Ajahn, I didn't get the part about how yoni-somanasikara leads to sati-sampajanya. When we are taught to develop mindfulness sati, teachers mainly talk about practicing present moment awareness, not much about wise attention. Can you please explain in more detail? Also, how is the full development of sati-sampajanya earlier in the chain different from the full development of the four satipatthanas later in the chain? Okay, so very often mindfulness is taught about, you know, just to be aware of phenomena in the present day, to kind of in the ordinary daily activities, and then to have that awareness, and then when the awareness is kept during the day, to continue that awareness in your meditation practice. But that is, of course, useful. It's useful to have a sense of mindfulness there, but usually it is only possible to have a certain amount, a degree of mindfulness during ordinary days. When you come to a meditation center like here, it's much easier to enhance that mindfulness and to become more aware, more get yourself more into the present moment. It's so much easier when you have the extra time, when you're having so many activities going on, so many duties to look after and all of these things. So I don't think we should really expect to be able to have that high degree of awareness in ordinary life. The basic mindfulness, the basic purpose of that is to enable us to live well, to have enough mindfulness, to know what is going on with your speech and your actions, ideally also with your thinking mind, right? Even the thinking mind sometimes is almost impossible to keep up with every thought we have. It just happens too fast. But at the very least, we can kind of have some degree of sense of what we are doing and what we are saying, and also some of the more, the more kind of major thoughts, tend to go on inside of us. And that is by far the most important part, because if you can be mindful of that, it means that you can be more virtuous, you can live better, you can be more kind, you can actually develop all of these things on the path that actually lead to mindfulness in the long run. It is not so much that mindfulness during daily life leads to mindfulness in meditation, that's not the main point. The Buddha doesn't actually say that. What he says, what leads to mindfulness, is your ability to be kind, to be virtuous, to have to be soft and gentle and caring for the people around you. That is really the foundation that leads to more mindfulness in the future. And I think that is sometimes a weakness in how meditation perhaps is taught. We don't focus enough on those things that really are the foundations for meditation practice to work. And that is why the idea of sampajanya early on in the path and yoni-somanasikara, these things go together in a very important way, because you understand whether what you're doing is appropriate or not. And then you use the yoni-somanasikara to guide yourself towards those things that are appropriate. You see anger rising and you ask yourself, how can I look at this situation in a different way? That is yoni-somanasikara. It is not enough just to be aware of the anger arising. That doesn't help. It helps a little bit, because at least you have the awareness, but it doesn't overcome the problem. There's a sutta in the Sanghita Nikaya which specifically says that mindfulness does not overcome anger. It is metta that overcomes anger. So when you see that there is a danger of irritation or something arising in your mind, you ask yourself, what are the other qualities of this person? And then you see, wow, they have all these good qualities. Why am I focusing on this silly little thing when there's so much beautiful qualities there? Yeah, and then you change your perspective. And as soon as you change that perspective, if you do it in time, if you do it before the negative thought becomes very strong or whatever, bang, out it goes, and you see the beautiful side of the person instead. This is yoni-somanasikara combined with sati-sampajanya and mindfulness. Sometimes it is not entirely clear which one comes first and which one comes afterwards, because all of these factors are important all the way on the path, right? All the way they are important. So the exact sequence of these things here, I don't think they matter all that much. But to get the idea how they work together here. Yeah, and then later on, one of the interesting things about the sutta as well, very often we are taught that Sampajanya, awareness of ordinary activities, is a part of Satipatthana. But I would argue from reading the suttas that the idea of Sampajanya, of being aware of what is suitable, what is appropriate in our ordinary activities, actually comes before Satipatthana practice. It is part of how to live well, how to live in the appropriate way. And then, when you come to your meditation, sitting down, then you are ready for that. Of course, there is Sampajanya in meditation as well, because when you sit down, right, you sit here, things are going through your mind, sometimes it is things that aren't really appropriate in your meditation sitting here. But then Sampajanya comes up and says, wait a minute, this is, I'm not really, you know, watching the breath anymore, I'm kind of fantasizing about something or whatever it is. And then you understand that, and then you do whatever is appropriate to continue your meditation in the right way. But Sampajanya also has this prior activity that we use in our ordinary activities. So sati and sampajanya don't always go together, or they go together, but they go together at different strengths outside meditation and then within meditation later on. Okay, so I hope that makes sense. If it doesn't, please try again and see what happens. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmāli, is it better to live in and off the world, happy and ignorant, or to suffer on the path? Okay, well, the idea of the Buddhist path, if you live it in the right way, it's supposed to bring you some happiness, right? There shouldn't be all that much suffering. So I would say that if you find the path to be a lot of suffering, then maybe you have to kind of change your attitude a little bit, right? Maybe you're not drinking enough cups of tea or something like that. This is one of the allowable things on retreat. You can drink as many cups of tea as you like and walk in the forest and enjoy the simple things in life. So start, when you start practicing this path and you start doing these things, you start with the most basic things, like just virtue, being kind, being compassionate, changing some of your bad habits, ordinary habits, right? And if you do that, I would say that you probably start to get some results straight away. And what is important to recognize is the connection between your actions and how you feel about yourself. If you see that connection, it doesn't take long before you start to understand that the spiritual life is far more valuable than any happy or ignorant existence in the world, right? It's a kind of a deluded kind of happiness. It's an underlying suffering which is going on that you're not really seeing, perhaps. So see the connection between your actions and your happiness. And it doesn't take, it's not that hard to see that when you do an act of kindness, you feel good about yourself. I think we all know that, right? You do something kind to somebody, you feel light, you feel easy, you know you're doing the right thing. You do something which isn't kind and you feel a bit kind of, oh, I shouldn't have done that. You don't feel happy about yourself, feel a bit miserable because of that. So the more we build up the positive things, the more good you feel about yourself. And the more you see that connection, the more motivation you have to live a more spiritual kind of life and less of the so-called happy and ignorant worldly life. And then you realize, actually, the suffering that you have on the spiritual path, yes, sometimes, of course, there is going to be some suffering that is inevitable, but it's kind of the suffering that you're willing to accept because the overall picture is far superior to any kind of other life that you might do. So look for the happinesses, see them, try to figure out where they are and how they work, and then you will see so much happiness on this path if you practice it in the right way. And this is one of the reasons why I don't recommend people to torture themselves on the common meditation retreat. I hope nobody here is torturing themselves. If you are, you're not following the instructions, right? So this is why it's so important to enjoy the meditation retreat, because otherwise how are you going to sustain this? It's impossible to sustain meditation practice if you don't actually enjoy what is going on. So be comfortable, be at ease, you know, have that, try to kind of bring up the positive perception, the good company, the beautiful facilities and beautiful forest around here, you know. I don't know. To me, this is such a wonderful place. When I like coming here, even though I love to stay in my cutie in the monastery, it's actually also very nice to be over here. It's slightly different. Yeah, but it's very beautiful to be here as well. So just enjoy this. And then when you get into the enjoyment, whoa, it becomes so nice and so beautiful. This is one of the reasons I never really had. For some people it might work, but for a lot of people, this idea of sitting very fixed and rigid periods of time, whereby you sit so and so long and you watch pain and all this kind of stuff, I think for many people it doesn't work very well. Much better to try to find the positive things in meditation from the very beginning here. So try it out, and if you still suffer, no, you shouldn't suffer if you try all these things. And if you still suffer, then try coffee instead of tea, if that happens, and see how things go. Okay. So, next one. Dear Ajahn, I came to meditation hall at 5 a.m. and had a good meditation for about 20 minutes. Suddenly, someone switched on the wall lights. Natural beauty of peacefulness disappeared. That was the end of my meditation. Thanks to Venerable Akaliko, who later on switched off all the wall lights, keeping one light on near the Buddha statue. Hope this will not happen again with metta. Okay, so I guess people would like to have the lights down during meditation. So, but don't try not to get upset about these things, because remember, this is samsara, right? Nothing, everything is out of control. These things are going to happen whether you want to or not. So just try to go with the flow. Sometimes these things are inevitable, unfortunately. So we try our very best, everyone, to look after each other and to care and to do the right thing. At the same time, please forgive those people who make mistakes, because it's so easy to make mistakes, right? Oh, we all make mistakes all the time. And then when you do that, you flow through these things with a sense of ease, not worrying so much about them. So that is good. Okay, so that's the next one. Dear Ajahn, in the number beginning of delusion is to be seen, because no beginning will be seen, because in the Aryan experience it is an oxymoron, namely there is no one to observe the arising of delusion, including self-view, when it first arises with metta and gratitude. It's not so much that there is no one to see it, that I don't think that is really the point. The point is more that you cannot see the beginning of delusion, because there is no beginning of delusion, right? Delusion just keeps on going back. It's not so much that it is an oxymoron because no one is there to see it, but it's simply that there is no first point. Delusion just goes back and back and back and back. And the problem with delusion is that it is self-perpetuating. Delusion creates more delusion. When you're ignorant, when you don't understand the nature of reality, you tend to create more of that same kind of problem in the future. So delusion perpetuates itself. Ignorance creates more ignorance. And because of that, the only way to get out of this is to have the Kalyanamitta, the Buddha, to say, wait a minute, this is the way to look at things. Try this way and then see what happens. And that is the only way to get out of it, because otherwise it is self-sustaining. And this is the problem. So when you go back in time and you look back on your life, you see that, go into past lives or whatever, from one eon to another one, it's kind of scary, right? You're going from one eon to the next one, the delusion is always there. It goes on and on and on, from eon to eon. After a while you think, oh, enough of this delusion business. And so you see this going on. There's no beginning to this. That is what is so scary. So what you understand, though, is maybe a little bit of the fluctuation in delusion. It fluctuates a little bit, but there is no absolute beginning to what is going on. So this is what makes Buddhism so exceptional, is that this idea of no beginning, this causes before causes, going back indefinitely. Okay. Azan, is there a way we can share the chairs for those that don't have one with Metta? Oh, we don't have enough chairs. That's interesting. Do we have more chairs that we can maybe... it should be. We used to have more many chairs in here. We don't have enough chairs. There are some spare ones at the back. Okay. Yeah, isn't it? Okay, so just grab whatever chair is available there. Yeah? And I hope this doesn't lead to any fights. We'll be in trouble. So, okay, so maybe we need to get some more chairs, and maybe we should have a few more chairs in here. Maybe that's a good idea. Huh? Okay, I'll put this one aside so I can kind of keep that in mind for later on. Okay. It's good to get this kind of feedback, because then we know if there are any discrepancies that need to be sorted out. Dear Ajahn, if there is time in the retreat, maybe towards the end, please explain broadly the Salleka Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 8, page 123. Is the Buddha saying the attainment of virtue is more important than the attainment of meditation, at least for beginners? Thank you. The Salleka Sutta is all about the higher experiences of meditation at the beginning. And what he is saying there is that meditation in its own right is not really sufficient. And it needs to be combined with many other things. In particular, it needs to be combined with right view. So even if you get very high states of meditation, if it is combined with wrong view, it doesn't actually lead out of samsara. That is what it's saying there. And it has this long list of defilements and things that you have to abandon, right? You practice the Salleka, is translated as effacement in English. So the word effacement is kind of a very unusual word, but it means like you are, it's almost like you are, reducing yourself in a sense, right? Reducing your sense of personality, reducing the sense of who you are. You're effacing yourself, like almost like you are erasing yourself in a sense, gradually erasing who you are. And of course, the most important thing to erase is the defilements, is all the negative aspects of the personality. So it's not, the Sutta doesn't say that samadhi is bad, because the weird thing is it starts off by saying that this profound samadhis, they don't lead to the end of the path. And then it says, but these things lead to the end of the path. And then it has samadhi in there, right? So it kind of sounds like a contradiction. But the point is that the real samadhi is a samadhi that comes, as you say, with virtue, and it comes with right view. And when right view and virtue are the things that support the samadhi, that is where the real effacement, the real erasing of defilements, the real erasing of self-view and all of these things, that is where it happens. That is a rough idea of what the Salleka Sutta says. So try to look at it in that light, and I think you probably will understand what is going on here. Okay. Dear Ajahn, you are super inspiring as usual. Okay, well, that's very kind of you to say that. Could you please lead us more at the reflective stage at the end of each meditation session? I'm not sure how to make good use of this reflection, which you said is very important. Thank you. Okay, so that's a good point. Maybe I can explain a little bit now how to do the reflection at the end of the meditation. So the point is that sometimes your meditation works. Sometimes you get some nice results. You feel afterwards, you feel peaceful, you feel nice, you feel good. Otherwise, other times meditation may not work at all. And you come at the end, you think, what on goodness was that? That was just terrible. And you kind of, nothing has really happened, or maybe you feel worse or whatever. But especially those times when your meditation is going well, look back at the process, right? And you will see that there is a reason why it is heading in the right way. There's a certain way that your perception is working. You're focusing on certain things that allows the mind to become peaceful. You will see that there is probably a softness in your mind. There is a gentleness. There is a positive perception of a certain kind. Right? All of these things. And you can see how those perceptions actually drive you forward and make you more peaceful and make you more relaxed, more at ease, moving towards even being able to watch the breath. Yeah, so reflect back and see how that process is unfolding inside of you. You will see that as you do that, there are certain things that you let go of as well, right? On that path, you're kind of letting go of certain thinking, you're letting go of maybe certain the past and the future and all this kind of stuff, because the perception also drives the letting go process. So look at that, see the qualities of your mind, the qualities of your heart that allows the meditation to work, and those qualities that don't. That is really all it is about. Yeah, and this will then, next time when you come to your meditation, you will then be able to direct your mind a little bit towards those particular mental qualities so as to enable the meditation to work again. So I hope that explains it a little bit at least. So try that out, and if you have any more questions about that, we can try again tomorrow maybe. Yeah. Okay, there's so many questions today. I've got to go a little bit faster than yesterday. Oh, that was an emptiness question. Yes. So, okay. Venerable Ajahn, what are the types of energy? Does a Buddhist have archetypal energies? For example, magician, warrior, etc. How do these relate with metta? Archetype, I think this is kind of some psychotherapy stuff, isn't it? Archetypes, this is Carl Jung or something. I think he talks about archetypes and magicians and warriors, that sort of stuff. Does Buddhism have these things? Not really. The only energy that we have in Buddhism is the energy of the mind that comes when your meditation is successful. The energy that comes with the joy, with the happiness, with a sense of well-being, when the defilements die down, there's a natural brightness in the mind, yeah? And that is the kind of energy that we are looking for. It doesn't really have any particular archetype related to it. It's just the energy that comes from a positive mental state. How do these relate? I have no idea how these relate. Sorry, I can't answer that one. So just go for the good positive energy, and you are in business. Okay. So please reconsider the use of aircon heating in the morning. It is killing the magical silence, replacing it with a constant humming noise like the city traffic. Reduce our carbon footprint too. Please don't be cold. Okay, use an extra blanket to keep warm. Thank you. Maybe we can vote on this. Okay. It is still the weather isn't not that cold, but it will get cold soon. This is kind of the cold time of the year, and I think that if you don't use any heater in the morning, you might get freezing cold in here in a couple of days' time. So I think the better solution, rather than not use the heater, is just to get used to the little bit of a humming sound. Don't allow it to distract you. Because that humming sound is like a background sound. It's not such a bad thing. It's very even. And the even sound, usually, if you are wise about that, you should be able to just allow it to be a background sound, which shouldn't disturb you too much. So this is one of the problems that we have. So people are so different in terms of their needs for heat and cold and all of these kind of things. But I think we should have some compassion for people. There are quite a few people here who come from overseas and come from places like Singapore. And for Singaporeans, anything under 25 is freezing cold, right? It's like ice and snow to them when they come from Singapore, if it's below that. So we have to have compassion for all of these people. So I think it is better, because we're going to have to use the heater anyway at some stage. So I would suggest, please try to bear with that little bit of noise. At least in my experience, I don't find it too problematic myself, because it is a kind of even noise in the background. Just think of it as a beautiful, beautiful noise of the beautiful, nice heat coming out. See it in a... Right? It's all about perception, right? Get the right perception, and there is no problem there anymore here. Okay. Ajahn Brahmali, can you give us some tips on dealing with the hindrance of sensual desire? Specifically, always thinking of my next meal, even when I'm not hungry. Okay, so always thinking of your next meal, even when you're not hungry. Well, that's interesting. That's usually the last thing people think. Even when you've just eaten, are you still thinking of your next meal? That would be very interesting. This is one of those things, you know, when all of these desires disappear, everything is really about coming back to this idea of enjoying your meditation practice, right? If you are thinking about your next meal, if you're not hungry, it probably means you're not enjoying your meditation all that much, perhaps. Just a suggestion. So if you're not enjoying it that much, then get up, do something else instead. Go for a walk, go back to your room, have a lie down if you feel a bit tired. Do some walking meditation, reflect on the suttas. Do something else just to change things around a little bit. And then perhaps the feeling of indulging in thinking about food will not be so strong. Usually these things arise because we think that there is some happiness to be had there, right? There's some kind of enjoyment in just thinking about food. And that is, of course, counteracted by finding the happiness somewhere else instead. And there's two things about meditation practice that makes it work. One is the idea of finding happiness in it, finding at least some peace, finding a sense of, you know, that this is a wonderful thing to do. So once you find that happiness, that tends to draw you towards the meditation object. And the other thing that makes it meditation important is to give it priority, to see it as something that actually really matters in your life. And I have always found that very useful, to think of meditation sessions as, this is when I come closest to the meaning of life. Everything else I do in my life is for the purpose of meditation practice. When I go back and when I, you know, help out in the monastery, whatever I do, all of these things that I consider good karma, I give a talk here, whatever it is, all of these things are good karma that I try to create to support my meditation practice. And if you see all of the things in your life as things that support your meditation, then meditation becomes really the thing that is the center of everything else. That becomes the priority. That becomes the most important thing. When you eat your meal, in such a way that it supports your meditation. Neither too hungry nor too full. Just the middle way. And when everything else becomes is kind of geared towards meditation practice, then when you sit down, you have come to the very purpose for what everything else is pointing to. You don't think about those things anymore because they are irrelevant. They are precisely the things that are pointing to the here and now. So you make give this the priority. This is where you find the real meaning of life. This is where you come the closest to that meaning of life anyway, and hopefully getting closer in the future. Find happiness there, find a sense of priority there, and then hopefully you can get rid of some of those fantasies about food. Maybe we should make the food worse. I think Bianca's food is too nice. I think that's part of it. Not Bianca's, it's actually all the people coming with the food. So maybe we should give them some bad recipes and say, make this kind of food, right? No, it's important to enjoy our food as well. I think that's really important, actually. I think if the food is bad, it will make it even worse. You think more about food. So it's good to enjoy your meals. Let's enjoy your meals and then be finished with it when you're finished. Okay. Dear Ajahn B, whenever I get bad thoughts or feel I'm getting angry or annoyed, I say this chant. May all beings be free from suffering. May all beings be free from illness. May all beings be well and happy. My question is this a good practice? When I keep saying this chant over and over, I feel I get over the feelings of ill will and anger. Am I doing the correct thing or just being delusional? Thank you for your kindness. Okay, so Everything we do is measured by whether it works or not, right? People often say, oh, is this right? Is it wrong? Is this bad karma, good karma? Why is this happening to me? And all of these kind of questions. But actually, it's not the things that we do. It is whether they work that really matters. So if this works for you, if it eliminates the ill will and the annoyance or whatever, then great, because maybe what's happening is that you are changing your perception by chanting that. By chanting, may all beings be from self. Maybe you are kind of switching your perception towards something positive, and that then helps you to overcome the negativity. But there are many ways of dealing with annoyance and ill will, right? And I've been talking very briefly about these things already. One of them is just to remember the good qualities in the people around you. And this is such a powerful way of doing it. This is one of the things that I always do in the monastery. When you live together with 25 monks or however many it is now, there's always going to be some friction in a large community like that. But at the same time, I always remind myself that these are people with the highest, most wonderful intentions in the whole world. These are people who are practicing to be kind towards themselves, to be kind towards the world, to realize a state of freedom from suffering and freedom from defilements. People who are doing the very best to do what is right in this world. What a wonderful thing that is, to even have that intention. Right? It's such a beautiful thing. And then when you see little stupid things, silly things happening in daily life, you can let go of that because the big picture is so beautiful and so inspiring. And this is what I recommend you to do, especially with the people who are here on this retreat, because these people here, everyone here has exactly that kind of intention. You're all like mini monks and mini nuns, right? When you come here for 9 days. That's basically what you are, because the 9 days you are here, you're keeping the 8 precepts, you're living pretty much like a monastic. There's no difference between you and a monastic. So if you enjoy this, well, maybe you should become a monk or a nun, right? You're already pretty much there already. So this is one way of doing that, and it's very powerful. It needs, of course, some practice. You need to think about this again and again, and you need to bring it to mind many times. But as you do that, it starts to sink in, and you start to realize it's actually true. And when it feels true, then it is very easy to shift the mind towards those positive things. So this is one way of dealing with this, and I will have more of a look at that later on this retreat. And this is what I would recommend more than anything else, because if you do that, it builds up that metta and goodwill inside of you. And that goodwill that you have to your fellows on the path, that is a very powerful support for your meditation practice. This other chant may work, but if you can build up the goodwill instead, even much more powerful than that. Okay. Ajahn, why did you say ill will is more serious a problem than sensual desire? Doesn't any hindrance block insight? Also, isn't it only at anagami stage that lust and anger are let go of? So until then, both these hindrances equally dog a practitioner. Many thanks for your teaching. Point here is that the ill will is more of a problem for meditation practice for many reasons. One is that we create more bad karma by having ill will. We create more disharmony in the community between people. Ill will is going to take you even further away from meditation than sensual desire, precisely because it is even more bad karma. It's a more unwholesome state of mind. If you get reborn with lots of ill will, then of course that is far worse karma in a rebirth process than simply having sensual desires. So because of that, it is the priority in meditation. Also, far easier to deal with ill will than sensual desire. Sensual desire is very tricky because it seems so nice, right? What's wrong with sensual desire? Just enjoying yourself, just having a good time, right? It doesn't seem very bad. Whereas ill will actually feels bad straight away. It's very easy to see why that is a serious problem. So deal with the easy things first. Deal with the most serious things first. And then you can look at sensual desire afterwards. Of course, you are right. It only stops completely when you become an anagami. But the point is, you can do a lot before you get to that stage. Anagami means it never arises again. But you can actually get rid of the vast majority of ill will long, long before you get to that particular stage. You can reduce it a lot. And that will empower your meditation so much if you do that. I will be talking more about both anger and sensual desire later on. There are some nice ways of thinking about sensuality, which is very useful on this path, I think, even for lay people, for monastics and lay people. I'll be discussing that later on. Hopefully that will be of a little bit of help for you in your practice as well. I have a friend who is very good-hearted, really kind, generous, helpful, forgiving. Yet her mind does not seem to settle easily into stillness. When she meditates, she says she thinks a lot. So is there more to it than just virtue leading naturally to stillness? I suppose that there are all kinds of habits in human beings, and some of us may have kind of very restless habits, perhaps, habits of thinking, etc. But generally speaking, there is a very close relationship between the goodness of somebody's heart and the ability to settle your mind in meditation. And one of the problems here, there's many things going on, and one of the things is what this person is like in this life. Right, but they may have a history, perhaps from earlier on in this life, or maybe from a past life or whatever, that was not so kind. And then it takes her a long time to overcome the things from the past life in order to actually still her mind in the present life. Our personalities are so complicated. We're conditioned by so many things. So many things have to come together to enable meditation to work. So we cannot really tell just looking at somebody externally to know exactly where their mind state is at. She may be heading in the right direction, but maybe she needs to continue doing this for even longer to be able to let go of these things. And also people are very different, right? Sometimes external things is one thing, but internally they may actually be slightly different. Sometimes people are very good-hearted and generous and kind and helpful because they have to really try really, really hard, because inside of themselves maybe they don't feel it so strongly. Yeah, so it is more of an external thing than an internal thing. Whereas other people have internalized this, and the generosity and the good-heartedness really comes from the inside. It is really a complete sense of integrity. It is fully part of who you are as a person. So you have to be very careful. Sometimes it can be people who may seem really maybe even harsh or tough or, you know, all of these kind of things. But actually, it is just a personality thing that they are very tough. People like, you know, some of these forest Ajahns, Ajahn Chah, I think some of these people could be very challenging. And they would sometimes challenge you in very kind of direct ways. And you may think, whoa, what is, you know, are they kind or are they not kind? You're not really sure what they are. They may not be angry, but they might be very challenging. And I look at somebody like Ajahn Brahm, for example, because of his extraordinary meditation abilities, very, very powerful samadhi. It gives him this very, very strong personality. He's a very strong person. And sometimes he can kind of be taken aback by the strength of the personality. It's almost like too much. And it's almost like you have to yield, in a sense, to somebody with such a strong personality. But it's not really coming from anger. It's just a very powerful force of nature almost it's almost like the samadhi coming out, this very strong mind, this ability to kind of just go forward regardless of what is happening outside of that person. And it gives somebody like Ajahn Brahm a tremendous independence, the independence to be able to do basically what he wants in the world without worrying too much about what other people think. That comes from that samadhi mind, that ability, that internal, incredible internal strength that comes from these kind of things. So it is often complicated. It's often difficult to see. Of course, if you see outright defilements, if you see anger, if you see ill will, if you see annoyance and these kind of things, then of course, you know, there is a problem. Those are really defilements. But if all you just see is a character which is quite very strong or resilient or whatever, then it's a different thing. Yeah? So we have to be wise when we judge other people in this way. Yeah? Okay, Ajahn, could you please briefly explain the difference between careful attention and mindfulness and clear comprehension? Thank you. With metta. So, the difference between the two, they are very closely related to each other, right? So, mindfulness and clear comprehension, the main part of that is to be, first of all, aware of what is going on. So you know what is happening in the present moment. And then the second thing, the clear comprehension part, the sampajanya part, is to know whether that which you are doing is suitable, whether it serves the purpose of your practice. If you are practicing the Noble Eightfold Path, and you want to practice right speech and right action, all of these things, you have to ask yourself, am I practicing right speech, right action? Am I practicing metta? Or am I practicing anger? So you know that. So that is the first thing. That is what mindfulness and clear comprehension is about. Yonisomanasikara is to be able to direct your mind in the right way. So if you know that you are heading, if you know that this is inappropriate, then yonisomanasikara is what helps you to direct the mind in the right direction. Okay, so this is heading towards anger. How do I avoid that? How do I make the mind head towards metta and compassion instead? And once you're able to make that shift is done by wise attention, yonisomanasikara. So yonisomanasikara, in a sense, is more basic and more profound. It's kind of one of those things that you have to have along with you all the way on the path. But these two things obviously come together, are very, very useful when they work together. Okay. Dear AB, okay, that must be short for Ajahn Brahmali. Thank you for sharing your knowledge and your humor. I hear you say, just by attending to the breath, the clearness, joy, tranquility, equanimity arise. I also hear you speak about the need to contemplate the problem list of hindrances, which I suppose are too many to count. How do I combine those two factors in meditation? But firstly, how do I start with discovering all my hindrances? By breathing gently, my mind becomes so still and empty. Thank you so much. That is wonderful. Your mind becoming still and gentle and empty by watching your breath. It's great. That means that you are already doing really well, right? You're doing really, it's a wonderful thing when that happens. So keep on doing that. Keep on that stillness. Keep on with the emptiness and make it more profound, even more still, even more empty. And see how far you can take that. Stay with the breath and just allow it, give it time, right? Sit there for as long as you feel comfortable, for as long as you are enjoying it. Often meditation has like a natural cycle, it goes well, and then suddenly you come out of the meditation. It's almost like you're finished, you're coming out of the cycle. So follow those natural cycles. When it's finished, it's finished. Then you do something else. But that's a wonderful thing to do. How do you know your hindrances? It's just by being aware of your mind, right? So when you are finished with your sitting meditation here, do a bit of walking meditation back and forth and just observe your mind and see what goes on in your mind. And if you are careful, you will be able to see what the main problems are, the main things that stop you. At the end of the sitting meditation as well, review the meditation. What happened? What were the things that worked? What were the things that didn't work? And you will maybe see that there are some hindrances there. Maybe a little bit of negativity, maybe some desires, whatever it is. And you will understand where your problems are. deal with any kind of negativity and ill will first of all. If there are particular people in your life that you find difficult, then deal with that. Sort that out. Find the good points in those people. Forgive them for the bad points. Understand that they are under other conditions in turn that make it difficult for them, impossible for them even, to be any different from what they are. And when people are prisoners of their own personality, prisoners of their own habits, if you really understand that, and this is what comes from the understanding of non-self, if you understand that, you can always forgive, you can always let go. Because it's terrible to be a prisoner of your own personality if you can't change, especially if you would like to change. And most of us would like to be kind because we know that kindness works. Yes. So because of that, then you learn to forgive those people that are difficult in your life. So two things. Continue with that stillness and emptiness that is great, and also know your problems. Understand your mind. Understand what is going on in your mind. So then, as you do that, as you deal with those hindrances, that is when the joy and the clearness, tranquility, and all of this stuff is allowed to happen. Because you are reducing the problems. As the problems reduce, the counterparts, the positive sides, tend to rise instead. So keep on doing what you're doing already. Already doing really well. I'm really glad to hear that you are heading that way. What a wonderful thing that is. Good luck. Okay. Dear Ajahn, okay, quote, this is quotes. You are a natural phenomenon. Let nature take its course. So this is what I said, I think, maybe to before another day here. I said that everyone is a natural phenomenon, and just like nature take its course. Thank you for saying this yesterday. I have been struggling to let go of control in my meditation, and this was exactly what I needed. Okay, that's great. So I'm very glad that you have discovered your inner natural phenomenon. That's really, really useful. It's quite nice, isn't it? It takes away some of the sense of importance and personality and I am like this, I am like that. You can just be completely natural, be who you are, nothing to prove, nothing to be. And as I said, as I'm going to say, maybe I'm going to say it tomorrow, the Buddha also is a natural phenomenon, right? So again, you are in good company there. Okay. Dear Ajahn, when a thought comes up during meditation, should we just observe and let it run its course, or gently let it go? Thank you for your advice. So these things are not different. Yeah, these things are pretty much the same. So when a thought comes up in your meditation, that is exactly what you do. You just observe. And by observing and allowing it to run its course, that is actually a way of letting it go. Once you start observing your thinking mind, the thinking doesn't normally last very long. Because usually the reason why we start thinking is because mindfulness is lost. The moment you start observing it, mindfulness has already returned. And then it tends to disappear all by itself. So just observe and observe. And then before you know it, the breath will have replaced the thinking mind. And then you're back on the breath again, or back on the metta, or whatever it is. If you do just by observing in this way, it is very effortless. It is very easy. It's almost as if you are doing nothing at all. You're just staying with it, observing it, allowing it to be. If you gently let it go, then that may already be a little bit too much effort, because then you are trying to let it go rather than allowing it to disappear by itself. Just observing and allowing it to disappear by itself is the same, really, as letting go, in this very effortless and very easy way of doing it. People often ask, the question is, when I lose the breath, should I guide the mind back onto the breath again? Don't have to do that. Don't have to guide anything at all. Because if you lose the breath, there comes a point when you are aware that you have lost the breath. The moment you are aware that you have lost the breath, you are already on the right track. You don't have to do anything else. So the moment you are aware of that, you just wait. Wait till the breath to come back again by itself. And then you stay with the breath again. Make it as natural as possible, as easy as possible. Almost no effort is required. All you have to do is observe. Because you are already pretty much pre-programmed, you know roughly where you're heading, right? Because of that pre-programmed, the mind will tend to, when the breath arises again, the mind will go there pretty much automatically. So allow it to happen by itself. Then it's so easy. It is so natural. No force, no tension, no sense of willpower involved at all, pretty much. Dear Ajahn, can you explain more on how faith give rise to wisdom? I didn't quite understand the process. So the process is, first of all, that the Buddha, we assume that the Buddha has some wisdom, right? This is kind of the basis. If the Buddha hasn't got any wisdom, then we are in serious trouble. So we have to assume that the Buddha has a little bit of wisdom. So that is the first one. And once you... I'm sure this is loud enough. Is this loud enough or is it not loud enough? Is it okay? Yeah? Okay, good. Okay, so sitting everything there. So because of that, then we start off with the wisdom of the Buddha and we place faith and confidence in that. And then we use that as our foundation for building up our own wisdom. But of course, it takes a little bit of wisdom to even understand that the Buddha had wisdom. We have to kind of, you know, fathom that first of all. So wisdom and faith always go together. You have a bit of wisdom. That leads to faith in some wisdom teaching. That gives rise to more wisdom, which gives rise to more faith, because you start to understand, wow, these teachings are actually really good. These are really profound teachings. And then as you practice those, even more wisdom, faith and wisdom going hand in hand in this way. But initially, we need some guidance. We need somebody to help us out on this path, to point ourselves in the right direction. And this is why here, in this particular case, it says that faith is the cause, the condition for yoniso manasikara, for the ability to attend wisely. So faith in the word of the Buddha says, attend in this way. You say, yes, sir, and then you do that, and you have good results, right? And you get more wisdom as a consequence. Okay, we'll do a few more. Oh, so many questions. Wow, it's amazing how many questions you have. Which is actually very nice. It's really good because it is important that we feel a bit connected, right? This is why we have the Q&A, to have a bit more connection. Otherwise, I sit up here kind of preaching all the time, which is kind of, after a while, gets a bit too much. So, dear Ajahn, associating with good people, what counts? Is it enough to just read the suttas? Listen to MP3s of Aryan teachers, though how is a little worldling to know who is really an Aryan teacher? Or is it also necessary to, or way more powerful to hear teachings from Aryan live in person, or live with or train under an Aryan teacher? You do what you can do, right? There is often a limit to what we can do, and of course, I think it is very helpful to be in the presence of Aryans, to see the live example of Aryans. I personally think that is very useful, because one thing is to read the suttas, but they are obviously a bit dry unless you have an example of somebody who has put them into practice and who has reaped the results. That is what gives you a very powerful confidence in these teachings, when you see that people actually have reaped the results of these things. So that combination I always found very powerful. The combination of the ancient teachings on the one hand and people who are still getting the results in the present day on the other hand. Together, that is a very powerful, powerful thing. So I would say a bit of both. So read the suttas. Also, have some faith and confidence of certain people that you may think are Aryans. It is It is difficult, as you say, to know these things, but at least you have some ideas, right? You have some ideas of people who have a degree of purity about them, a degree of integrity about them, who have these qualities that you would expect of the Aryans. Not much anger, ideally no anger at all, a lot of compassion and metta, a sense of wisdom about them, peace, deep meditation. Sometimes you see them sit there and they kind of know that they have deep meditation, right? There's a story of Ajahn Brahm, and he was sitting, this was a long, long time ago when he was still in Thailand, and he was sitting on the seat, on the Dhamma seat. Usually there the monks would sit on Dhamma seats like this, and the lay people would also be in the hall sitting in front. And Ajahn Brahm was sitting there, and he was sitting for so long, and he was sitting so still, right? This is what happens when you get into really deep meditation. You become completely still. You can't see any breath. You can't see anything at all going on. And this layperson said, "Oh, I think this monk over there, he must have died, right? There's no movement. It's like a rock. It's been there for hours. Okay, start off the funeral pyre, because we're going to have to, you know, to burn him." And this is what happens, right? Sometimes you see these things and you know that somebody has very, very profound meditation experiences. When you can sit there for 5 hours and so you look like a rock for 5 hours, you know something is going on, something exceptional. So sometimes you get these little glimpses of things that are very exceptional and very impressive, and then you look at the overall picture and you have some idea who the Aryans in the world are. But have a healthy skepticism about this, because there are many people who are not Aryans. Everybody likes to think that my teacher is an Aryan. My teacher too is an Aryan. Everybody says that, and you can't always trust those things. I say that too. I say my teacher is an Aryan, right? So what can you... Anyway, so you have to figure that out for yourself. But, you know, so feel... just feel what feels good. Go back to the suttas as your final resource, and then also listen to good talks by people who you think are giving you right teachings. If you think that I'm talking all rubbish when I'm here, then find another teacher, right? That's the only way to do it. Okay, if 3 and 4 are not available options for one, can one still break through to stream entry, even if it may be harder? If you don't train under an Aryan or hear teachings from an Aryan live, yes, it is possible, of course, to break through to stream entry. It is a long way down the road for the majority of people, but it is possible, at least, occasionally it is possible. These things can happen. What do you think would be more important or helpful to progress on the path, to live as a lay practitioner or an agarika in a monastery meditation center with an Aryan teacher, or to become a bhikkhu-bhikkhuni and practice more rules of restraint, even if one has to be in a monastery without an Aryan teacher? Sorry for the long question. Thank you. This is very difficult to say, to be honest. Ideally, you would find a monastery where you really feel that you find the right teachings, and when you feel at home and you feel relaxed, you feel at ease, you have the right company getting the right teachings. I personally think that is very important, and I think it's perfectly maybe better perhaps to be a lay practitioner or an anagarika in a place that you feel really is the right place for you. You don't really know who is the Aryans in this world, that is quite true. But it is important to feel that you are in the right place. I think that is very important. That's what I did. I started off in the UK as an anagarika, and then I heard one talk by Ajahn Brahm, and when I knew one talk, I knew this is my teacher. I got to the phone, called up Australia. Can I come to Australia? Yes, you can come. Bang! I was in Australia. I've been here ever since, right? So it was definitely the right decision. So it is, I think that is actually, it is important to have that sense that you are in the right place. The most important thing with being a bhikkhu or a bhikkhuni is not so much the rules of restraint. Yes, they are useful as well. But if you are an anagarika, you're already very close to being a monk or a nun, right? All of you here now, you're pretty much monks and little nuns, right? So welcome to the fold, so to speak. Yeah. And so the more important thing with being a bhikkhu is more the ability to be part of a community which is practicing in the right way, to have good teachers that guide you in the right way, to have good facilities that enable you to practice properly. That, I think, is by far the most important part. Kalyanamitta, right? That is the source of all the other things. So the kalyanamitta is what really matters. This is what I personally find that I have found at places, a place like Bodhinyana Monastery here, is that sense of spiritual companionship that guides you in the right direction here. That, I think, is number one. So, see how you go here. So hopefully you will find the right answers for yourself. Oh, it's already 10 past 9. I probably should have turned these questions upside down, because I have a feeling that, you know, the poor persons, people who wrote the questions yesterday, the questions are still at the bottom. That's terrible, isn't it? Okay, we'll stand them up on one side like that, and we'll do those first tomorrow. Okay, but I better stop there, because it's getting quite late. So, that is it for now. So have a nice night, have a good rest, and we'll see you again tomorrow morning at 6 a.m.